I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're joined by one of the world's foremost philosophers, Slavoj Žižek, to discuss the global crises that we face and how to maintain hope in these dangerous times. I'm not sure that Slavoj needs much more of an introduction. Amongst public intellectuals today, he is one of the most well-known. And he even gave Jordan Peterson a run for his money. I would say he beat him in a rather infamous debate back in 2019. In this conversation, Slavoj and I will cover a number of topics, including the COVID pandemic, the mental health crisis in these trying times, digital surveillance, catastrophic climate change, the corporate Great Reset of the World Economic Forum, and much, much more. But one aspect of this conversation that I think was really important is the way in which Žižek says that we must not lose hope and that we should reject depression in these difficult and dangerous times. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to the conversation with Slavoj Žižek. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest I've been wanting to have on for some time now, Slavoj Žižek. We're going to be talking about the global crises facing the world right now. Slavoj, how are you doing? And what do you think the biggest crisis we're facing right now is? Because I think even if we get past COVID, we're going to be facing more crises in the future.
Now you already brought me into the very heart of today's debates, because the predominant perspective still is, when will we return back to normal? Of course, maybe you know this line of thought, but I think it's not my line of thought. Namely, just be careful and observe how our time coordinates are changing. You remember a year ago, the magic number was 2 weeks. 2 weeks, it will be tough, then it will get better. Even Fauci at that point was promising already in May you will be able to go to Then in the summer, it became 2 months. 2 months, it will be tough, then worse. Then in the winter, it became half a year was the magic number in, I think, around December. Half a year, next summer, it will be yours. Now, it's just indefinite. You know, you never know, maybe masks will need until 23, 24. And it is, I will come to answering precisely your point.
I was going to say, by the way, Bill Gates was saying now by the end of 2022, the goalpost keeps moving with when we're going to, quote unquote, go back to normal.
Yeah. The second thing linked to this one is that we learn, but honest scientists were always clear about this. Just false popularizers were, were cheating. Namely, that the more we know, the more we discover how little we know. Like, we think a country is well, arrange everything under control, then it explodes. And it's easy to play this game apropos Brazil, where they have a mad president and so on and so on. It's much more difficult with other countries. So till now, only two things I think are relatively firm. That A, I hope this is good news. Vaccination up to a certain point works. Look at Israel, which now had ridiculously low numbers. Even United Kingdom and so on. And second thing, don't underestimate this. It's not just that the only thing that really works is the Chinese totalitarian model where lockdown means you are literally locked down. No, it's more complex. I think good social organization of solidarity works. Again, this may sound anti-communist, but one has to be honest and say there is an even greater success story than China, which is Taiwan. It has incredible low numbers. And another, let's be honest, towards communists in power, Vietnam is also a miracle. A poor country, but they simply mobilized, a friend from there told me, what they kept from decades ago, the era of the war with United States. Namely, they were often bombed, communications were interrupted, so they had this local network of solidarity, organization, and so on. So, but now I didn't lose my track, although you think I did. I will come to the crucial point. Yeah, there is a medical crisis. Who knows how it will end? Yeah, it is coming, but there will be the economic consequences, which are already here. Because this is what I always repeat, and please interrupt me if you don't agree, because I like fights among comrades. The problem is long term. For short term, now you can give trillions and credits, print money, blah, blah. It goes up to a certain point. But, and these are very important changes for global capitalist system. So we live in an extremely paradoxical epoch where, on the one hand, we live in a period of like depressive numbness. Oh my God, many of my friends simply stopped following news. They say it's basically the same all the time. And this is what causes such a depression. There is no clear narrative. If you behave good for half a year, then you can go to Florida, to Paris, whatever you dream of. I dream of neither of these two places.
No. Right, but you're right. The narrative is always changing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So on the one hand is this idea of we move, we don't move. But at the same time, this is what I always repeat, we live in an extremely politicized moment. Are we aware how much measured at all different levels things are changing? How much more concentrated, that's the usual point, of course, how much more concentration of wealth there is among the rich. Or, very sad, because in spite of all bad comments about me, it may surprise you, I feel almost like saying an obscenity or what. But I consider myself a real feminist who really cares and is deeply affected by everyday women's suffering. And this is incredible what is happening. The pandemic, lockdown and so on, was a catastrophe for women. According to some estimates, it brought, if you measure it in a simple way, feminist struggle for about 30, 40 years back. And the most oppressive aspect is visible in what I call, in a very evil way, the new East European axis of evil. Poland, Hungary, and my own country, Slovenia. But also Turkey. You know, when Turkey stepped out of the ironically called Istanbul Convention. Also in Slovenia, in Hungary, wanted. That is to say how part of the establishment used this to hit women and so on and so on. Racism, we know. Just look at the numbers. So we have this social economic moment. But if you ask me, don't be afraid, I will stop soon. If you ask me what I fear most, and I will explain why, I don't know why it is in the United States, all around Europe, and I talked with some psychiatrists here in Slovenia, is the psychic consequences. Conservatives, I forgot his name, Paris, like the city of Paris, I think, a relatively conservative but not stupid German sociologist said, use this expression, it sounds nice, ominous in German, Zerstörung des Alltags, destruction of everyday life. He points out how our everyday life involves implicit customs, all that, and all that is disappearing, people are breaking down. For example, in my own, as your beloved ex-president Trump would have put it, shithole of a country, although his wife is from there. Slovenia, all the psychiatric wards are so full of adolescents that now, even if you're in, I don't know what kind of a crisis, the condition to be accepted to a psychiatric ward is that you have a clear tendency and real danger of a suicide. I mean, the whole generations are changing their habits, are missing this everyday socialization. And I think that what some people call this refusal of knowledge, you prefer non-knowledge, it's not stupidity, it's the basic choice between accepting what we know, which means everyday life is lost, we will have to reinvent new normality, people simply find this too much, and with all the changes, we in Slovenia, for example, are here much more horrible than you, I think United States, because our government is even worse than other European government. They change the rules almost every couple of days, not even every week. And people are simply totally frustrated. You know, at one point you can be fined for the, it was such a scandal. A guy who was sitting on some stairs alone, nobody 20 yards around him, and was eating a hot dog, I think. He was fined €400, almost $500. Next day, it was no longer prohibited. So people are frustrated. So if you ask me, I know that one shouldn't be cynical about the physical suffering, poverty, and so on and so on. But behind this, I see a real threat of psychic disorders, which, be careful, are not just a matter of your inner psychology, inner life. They will explode in social disorders, people no longer respect the law, the state, whatever. And I think that we leftists should hear, it may sound horrible, we should discover the law, the good side of obeying, because again, as you probably know, my ultimate scene was the Trumpian crowd invading Capitol, no? And maybe you know this story. I was shocked how many of my radical leftist friends told me, oh my God, this is wonderful. Just not the right people are doing it. We should be doing it. I told them, are you crazy? Revolutions are not made like that today. Revolutions are made by people much more like Julian Assange, bringing out the secret data, all that happened. A true revolution occurs at an invisible level. Invisible, by this I mean not clearly visible in the public, when things change already at that level. That's where real fights go on. So again, I will conclude now just by repeating my own point, which I used in a couple of my texts. Don't dismiss these ordinary people, some of them Trumpists, who claim lockdowns, social isolation are destroying my human dignity. I no longer feel human. You know, in some sense, this is true. The task we are facing today is extremely hard. This is one point. The second point, to answer a question, it's not just COVID. First, COVID will not be over so quickly with new variants and so on and so on. But then, unfortunately, I believe those who point out that COVID will be followed with other ecological catastrophes, bushfires, global warming, and so on. And one should be very concrete here what this means. I've written about it. Look at bushfires in California and on the other side of the world in Australia. Of course, nature always comes back, but the problem is it's not the same nature which comes back. Totally different bushes or trees are occupying now the terrain, which imply, which tolerate different animals and so on, which is a catastrophe for us. That's why I don't like this idea of, you know, respect Mother Nature, we shouldn't hurt Mother Nature. Don't worry about Mother Nature, it will survive. The problem is, will there be a place for us in the new nature that is emerging? So again, the big, it's a tragic lesson, very difficult one, but the big dilemma is, for me, are we able to break this dream of suffer, let's suffer a little bit, let's be tough, and we will return to normality? No. We will not, and even those in power, I mean in power, so-called deep state and big business, know it secretly. Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and so on and so on. So it's a very tough decision to construct normality in normal circumstances. You say, let's take some time, don't be nervous. No, we have to be nervous. We don't have time now. Sorry.
The question that I think arises is, we're sort of being offered this vision now from people like Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum, this idea of the Great Reset. This is what we're going to have to do to combat climate change and catastrophe and pandemics. What do you think about this idea of the corporate Great Reset? And is there another option outside of that, that maybe the left can offer as opposed to the Great Reset?
My problem with the Great Reset, insofar as I read some texts on it, it's not that it may work, but we will lose too many liberties. I don't think it will work. There are so many hidden catches, problems in it, you know. The Great Reset is basically guided by the idea of how to change something so that overall they remain the same, put it like this, you know. And they are ready to risk many things, but basically the system remains the same. So I think, and people tell me I'm a utopian. No, I'm not saying nationalize everything, socialist planning and so on. I'm not saying that. Keep the market where it works. Isn't it absolutely clear already with the threat of global warming, the first global approach, there has to be some mechanisms that would enable an effective global approach, because obviously some parts of the world will be hit in a terrible way. In other parts, life will be possible where it wasn't possible till now, like the northeastern Siberia and so on, but which brings other problems and so on. So global, and all, most of the people even admit at the level of works, of course, only that even pandemic can be beaten only at that level, that if you are not New Zealand, but even there, it works only for some time. You cannot say we will have our nice bubble and then it's your problem what happens out there. No, I think that, I'm not saying abolish market. I'm an old Marxist who learned from Marx that capitalism can be incredibly productive. Competitions and so on. That's why I don't talk about a new world government, this leftist utopia. I even prefer not to think what kind of mega unimaginable corruption this could be. I'm just talking about coordination. For example, it's absolutely clear that we need not only universal healthcare in a country, but global healthcare. It's absolutely clear that without, now comes my crucial formula, without reducing struggles to one, that is to say, essentialism, only ecology matters, now only pandemic matters. This is for me the most terrifying misuse. When they say, okay, let's get rid of coal and oil, it's nice, but sorry guys, now we have pandemic, that should be put in the background. No, we have a whole series of overdetermined struggles. We have ecological struggles now, health struggle, pandemic, we have exploding racism, social struggles. We are in front of new social struggles, economic struggles, my God. And here I think we should do something that till now the left was not ready to do. Wasn't the left always too, in a bad sense, I like the term essence, but in a bad sense, we were too essentialist. We were always looking at every, I think the different historical points of moments of leftist movement can be defined by the idea which model of proletarian working class was the model. For example, which species, which particular mode was elevated into the representative of the universality. For example, I had a nice long talk with Alain Badiou years ago where he said, late 19th, early 20th century, it was between miners, those who dig up coal, and steel workers. No, like these are the true proletarians. Maybe later in the mid-century, it was Ford car manufacturing, that is to say, this collective work where you just repeat the same gesture and so on and so on.
So the question is, who are they today?
I don't think there is one. There is one case. There are men. On the one hand, don't we witness today a triumphant reassertion. I love you for smoking. My wife also smokes. I think smoking is healthy, especially passive smoking. I like the smell without sucking it. Sorry for this brief interlude, but you know what I hate with my friends? The same stupid leftists who hate smoking, you are killing me, how can you? Have no problems with legalizing even hard drugs, you know. Do you notice this where they are often, you know? Okay, let's go back.
So you were talking about the...
So today we have on the one hand, yes, where are the Marxists right? Those who emphasize that don't focus on, it's an old Marxist motive, don't focus on this exploited working class. The formula is, for this exploitation to work, there has to be a lot of unpaid work, like housewives, servants, and so on, work which is kept even outside the proper capital and laborer exploitation. That this invisible, not invisible in the sense that we don't see it, but invisible in the sense that it's work which is not caught into the process of evaluation in the sense of you sell your labor force and so on. So the first focus is this one. And maybe you know here my line, I even think I agree with some European leftists who introduced the term like exploitation of existence. Look at what happens now, for example, north of Canada, where they're doing the fracking. Nobody is exploited. Okay, maybe. But workers are relatively well paid, but they are destroying the natural habitat of the, what's the politically correct terms? Indigenous people, first people, Inuits, whatever. So you see, you can be ultra exploited without being directly part of the reproduction. So the solution here, as my good friend David Harvey taught me, it's not universal commodification, because you know this probably, that some leftists propose the option of commodifying everything. Women are exploited, okay, they should be paid especially for their home exploitation. No, I don't think this works. Okay, so this is all those colonized people, women and so on, whose exploitation is not visible. Then don't forget about the old working class, which is nonetheless still here, not only in the third world. You know what's happening now with Bezos, with Amazon, no? Where they, in a masterful operation, my God, I almost love them, how they manipulated so that workers themselves voted against trade organizing in trade unions.
You right, know? In Bessemer, Alabama, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So again, and not even to mention the classical work exploitation in third world countries. Then we have a tremendous exploitation of precarious intellectual work. Yes, a couple of guys earn a lot. But you know how many, even friends of mine, like once every 2-3 years, they are lucky, you get a good contract. But even if you somehow survive and you are not poor, it's permanent tension all the time. And here one has to be creative, I believe, not even in as an anti-capitalist move, but as the first step, some kind of universal basic income, so that you are not always on the edge of and so on. So again, you know where now I see the problem here. Of course, the old Marxist dream is we should strive for unity, all of them together, you know, like a good Israeli but pro-Palestinian friend of mine told me recently, my most sublime moment was when in the West Bank, some LGBT Israeli women with all their violet yellow hair and all that usual stuff joined Arab women covered with covered faces to protest against. Yeah, but I'm a little bit more of a pessimist here. I don't believe in this big popular mobilization. The formula, and not only in developed countries, in third world countries, also in developed countries, is that you have a vision of popular mobilization, but then you discover that this is not what really happened. Look at Turkey. I remember a couple of years ago, 1 million people in the center of Istanbul, blah, blah. They thought, okay, now we are there. No, in the election, Erdogan won, silent majority and so on. Look in Egypt, they overthrew Mubarak. What happened? In Algeria, it was the same. Years ago, you get Muslim Brotherhood in power. So I think we should draw the consequences on this. The only strategy I see is that it may even sound cynical that from time to time, there is a miraculous moment when the educated, but low and middle class educated, unemployed computer programmer students, which has no clear perspective of getting a job, come together with workers so that their fights resonate. And now this will sound cynical, but we should always be aware that this resonance will not last for long. At that point, you should grab power and actualize whatever you can of progressive measures and so on and so on. So let's drop this utopia of there is a true substantial representative of the people, either women, although I agree with or colonized or whatever. Although I agree with women, I don't know if you already sold to you this motive of mine that, you know where we should be critical towards Marx? Here feminists are right. The big shift towards domination didn't happen with class societies. All good historians of early humanity know this. It was Neolithic. When from hunters, we passed on to established settlements with field agriculture and so on. At that point, patriarchal domination and so on emerged. And what is great with Me Too is that they are in some sense even more radical than class struggle. Class struggle emerged with Oriental despotic state, but this was before. The problem I nonetheless see here is that establishments knows this and is proposing new forms of subjectivity where you no longer have patriarchy and so on, but you still have capitalism, you know. So you know what I mean? I mean, let's avoid this simple dreams of a big unity. The situation is irreducibly open. Second thing, not only the situation is open, but these different emancipatory struggles can also, and this is not a secondary corruption by those in power, can get in conflict with each other. Like people say we should unite feminist struggle and anti-colonialist struggle. Okay, but you know, from my youth, I remember a terrible fact. I'm old enough to remember it. When Kenya became independent, of course, the clitoridectomy, which was prohibited under the English rule, returned. And when liberals there protested it, you know what was the reply? No, this is our struggle against colonialism, prohibiting clitoridectomies and so on and so on. So I reject both extremes here. I reject this simple Western enlightened view. We know the truth, what is civilized, we should enlighten the primitives. But I also reject, which is especially important today, this simplistic third worldism, you know, in the sense of the underdeveloped nomadic proletarians or whatever, they are the truth. No, we should never, never forget that the language of emancipation that we use is the language of Western tradition. For this, what I will tell you now, many people hate me, that there is something unique about Western tradition in the sense that I don't know any other civilization which was able to develop such powerful instruments of denouncing itself, of its own self-criticism. I talk too much, strike back.
I guess the last thing I wanted to touch upon with you is we're living in very frightening times. We seem to be moving.
But not just that, sorry to tell you, you know, sorry to interrupt you, but do you know that if you look at the data, you know, it's not as simple as that. Things are still progressing, industry, medicine, and so on and so on. The tragedy of our time is precisely as I like to quote him, Dickens said at his most famous beginning of The Tale of Two Cities, you know that, a life of hope, a life of despair. What makes our situation today so frustrating is that at the same time, technology, social movements, fight against racism, for women are soliciting incredible hopes, but at the same time is despair. Yes, sorry that I interrupted you, please go on.
Well, I was going to say one of the things I've always admired when listening to your various talks and reading various books is you always say that we should face the future and not be afraid. You've always said, I am not afraid. And I think there's something
today,
very valuable in that.
But today this is extra difficult, you know, because there is no predetermined future. Now, I just finished a new text on Hegel where I draw in a very nice way and incidentally, let's make propaganda for them. There are women which I hate, but with clenched teeth, I must admit something. In the last years, practically all big books on Hegel were written by women, you know, and I proudly admit it. So two of them, Angelica Nuzzo and Rocío Zambrana, developed very nicely this point that the basic Hegel's insight, which is obliterated by Marx, a little bit, is that it's not enough to think the transformation, social transformation, but in transformation, thinking itself should change. Like you begin proletarian struggle by Marxism and so on. But when you fight, you see with the sometimes tragic results of your struggle, Stalinism, fascism, and so on, that the basic coordinates of what you strived for has to be rethought. Like, it's clear that Marxists at some point put too much faith into centralized, efficient state apparatus and so on and so on. So this is what is, I think, so important today. The readiness of the left to not only to, in this paranoiac way, to analyze more in detail the enemy, but to ask how the first step, the conceptual horizon through which we approached crisis and what to do, had its flaws, so that in a process we should rethink our own position. It's clear, for example, that it's an obvious example, that Marxism, although Marx was very sensitive to for ecological exploitation, as Kohei Saito, the Japanese guy, wrote in his Eco-Socialism, in the last 10 years, this is wonderful, Marx. Marx was obsessed with geological studies, studies of how man's intervention changed nature, which is beyond this classical Marxist approach, which still presupposes that nature is there as a material to be exploited. But nonetheless, the basic horizon of Marx is this naive trust in workers' struggle. Yeah, feminism, good, ecology, good, colonialism, good, I mean good to fight colonialism, and more or less automatically other problems will be solved. We have to renounce this clearly.
So in closing, I just, I'm wondering, what is the horizon in terms of hope for the future and for the left? What do you think the big, what are your hopes for the future? What do you think? I want to end on an optimistic note is what I'm saying, Slavoj.
Now I will give you a double paradoxical answer. First, I'm sorry, this cheap paradox that I often use, I'm sorry to repeat it, but I'm a moderate optimist because I'm a pessimist. That is to say, you know, when you are an optimist, you are always disappointed. It's hell. It never happens. But if you say, generally, our situation is shit, you know, then, you know, from time to time, things happen. People mobilize here, there is a struggle there, and so on, and so on. So we should always remember this Walter Benjamin thought, which I often quote, behind every fascism, there is a failed revolution. Isn't it clear that Trumpian populism is a reaction to the basic dissatisfaction of many working people by the standard centrist liberalism? It was a potential there, which is why, as I put it in my text on inauguration and so on, now you will say I'm dreaming. No, people know this, and I will give you an empirical proof in the best English empiricist way. You remember that viral image of Bernie Sanders sitting alone at the inauguration? Did that image became viral? Because millions of people read it as a sign that, sorry, it's nice that Trump went, but we don't buy this self-celebrating spectacle of Biden, that something more is needed. This is not really our event. So although who knows what will happen and so on, my trust is that every defeat can be made into a step towards some progress. So don't get caught neither in this simple multicultural identity politics. No, we need universal solidarity, but also not in this global fake universalism. You know, leftists like to say Biden, no, maybe even worse than Trump, forget about it. No, now we have this $2 trillion, blah, blah. Okay, we should do what AOC did and criticize it. But at the same time, we should grab it, engage in it, not in a sinister communist way. We pretend to support it because we will then use the opportunity to establish. No, we should fully support it, because our leftist wager is that if we do it, and if we really want to do what this $2 trillion money, new investment is supposed to do, then we will have to go on and on and on. You know, this trust I have, don't be afraid of defeats. There are wrong defeats and there are also productive defeats. Defeat is a unique opportunity for a, how to put it, for a learning experience. That's why it makes me so sad, this conflict between AOC and socialists. I don't see, there shouldn't have been a conflict here. There is no contradictory between being well aware of the limitations of Biden, but at the same time of seeing how some of the things he tries to do can be, or even are now, an important step forward. My God, we are talking about $2 trillion, about massive investments and so on. I am aware this doesn't mean automatically we won. No, there will be cheating, tricks and so on, but don't be afraid to engage. That would be my lesson. The cheapest way is this eternal passion. Like many of my radical leftist friends, they said, Occupy Wall Street. Ah, they talk about 99%, but they were really 1%. Yes, they were. And they lost. It just the movement, Occupy Wall Street, dissipated. But wait a minute. Without them, I doubt if there would have been Bernie Sanders and so on. You know, like, I believe in this gradual learning process. And so in this sense, I am not neither an optimist nor a pessimist. I just think that we live in a very dangerous time, but at the same time, a time of hope. We should never accept this defeatist, determinist position. You know, what can we do now? It's a medical emergency. We can't do anything. I doubt if capitalism itself has ever changed so radically in 2 years as it is now. We live in a time of change. And even all the things that we think are just negative, like you mentioned this question, digital control and so on, you know. No, this is a very ambiguous phenomenon. On the other hand, mass media enable digital control and so on, we know this. Although, why connect this with pandemic? My old motive is, are we aware how we were already controlled before pandemic? A pandemic. I don't care if they control where I move and so on. My point is that you know that at least three states that I know, Israel, China, and the United States, all your messages, phone calls, everything is already controlled. The point is just two things. A, to make this control visible, I at least want to know how, to what extent I am controlled, no, and to use this openness of internet for our cause. Internet is not just, sometimes when you read leftists, the only authentic democracy was before internet, well, this is one of your American dreams, exploited even by Trump. When you have in a small city, around the town hall, a square, and real democracy happened there where people meet. No, any of these recent revolutions, okay, social upheavals, happened through digital media. That's why, did you notice how the first thing dictators do, like coup d'etat in Myanmar now, is you suspend internet and so on. So it's ambiguous. We can use it. Don't get caught in this fake imitation of late Frankfurt School, where they see in technological progress only another means of total control and so on and so on.
No, well, anyone can use this technology as a weapon. Our enemies can use it, but we can as well.
Yes, and here again, here we should again not be afraid. Don't be afraid. Or as my good friend Fred Jensen, when I wrote him an email a couple of months ago, I'm depressed, he answered me wonderfully. He said, for a true leftist, pessimism is allowed, depression is forbidden, prohibited. No, like, see, the pessimism, when you paint a distraction, always has horrible things happen, but has a positive aspect. It's a new chance. It's a new chance. That's why I reject some of the Marxists who claim, like social democratic liberal Marxists, who claim whenever there is a crisis, a disorder, it's usually used by anti-Semitic neo-fascists and so on. Yeah, but then their conclusion is, so it's in our interest that we don't have crisis. No, I want to keep this Marxist spirit. Crises are a symptom of the system. We should learn to use the crisis, not in a destructive way. Let 10 million people die just that we make our point, but with all the responsibility towards ordinary people. Here I'm really respectful. For example, I hate my friends who prohibit any criticism of Cuba today. No, nonetheless, they were boycotted, they heroically, by United States, they heroically resisted it. But let's face it, Fidel Castro himself admitted in one of the last interviews, they didn't produce a new model. It's a deadlock. It's the same with Chavez. It's a deadlock. If anything, the left should be able to do this to the end. No false hopes here. No.
Well, I want to thank you, Slavoj Žižek, for joining me on Parallax Views. But cutting short
censorship, I believe in creative censorship. Like, thanks very much. I really appreciate it. And how do you survive? Publicity alone?
I do this full time. I do about 3 to 4 shows a week. I used to.
Okay, but where does it come? Money.
I use a Patreon account, and I also have some. I have a sponsor or two, actually. So that's my way.
I hope you will survive, because do you know? Just let me finish with a personal reflection. You must have noticed how I am. And people say everything is prohibited. I'm a clown in the service of capital. Yeah, but thanks, because did you notice how I'm more and more excluded from public space?
Yes.
It was New York Times. I was out Guardian. I was thrown out Independent. Now I'm even out of Independent. Russia Today, I try to avoid, you know. So this is a good sign, even. It means that, no, it's not through this simplistic idea you can say everything today. No, there are limits. You cannot say everything. And I don't mean dirty words, obscenities. Obscenities, you can say them today. No, Trump was doing it and so on. But simple insights, like I will mention my enemy, like many of the things that Chomsky is saying are also prohibited, sidelined, and so on. So really, let's not lose hope. Thanks very much to you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with the one and only Slavoj Žižek. And I hope, like him, you'll find reasons to maintain hope in these dangerous times. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter @ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Brian, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.